accession number 10600, reel 8.
Mr. John Wainwright, reel 8. I'd like to look at how life in the trenches changed between June and August, which is the next bigger action. You mentioned earlier that dysentery began to make its appearance.
Yes, it certainly did. But generally, the position after the 4th of June was, to some extent, as I mentioned before, it was something of a stalemate. We held the trenches, but it was a case of holding the trenches for being a week or a fortnight at a time, perhaps going back into reserve for a week. So we're backwards, and sometimes we went back into reserve onto working parties, helping to unload the trawlers coming in with stores and ammunition and so forth. So it was a case of backwards and forwards to the trenches. But it wasn't long after the 4th of June. I think it must have been around about that time that really dysentery started and got hold of the troops. And it seemed to be everybody suffered from it.
You suffered from it.
Oh, yes, I had a bad go of dysentery. But I never reported sick. I never went sick. I never went back to the doctor. Some of them did, but I just stuck to it all the way through, and I never reported sick.
Did it weaken you badly?
Well, I mean, one of the points is, I mean, it was absolutely terrific sort of diarrhea or something, you know, running all the time, and it was just like a sort of very, very severe diarrhea all the time. But on top of that, apart from the dysentery, there was all these septic sores. I think, I don't know whether I've mentioned them before.
You mentioned them, yes.
But this seemed to be one of the things. And in some ways, that was just as bad as the dysentery, worse in some respects. But it meant that any part of your body that was bare, and a little bit of a scratch or a cut or anything, no matter what it was, on your knees or on your hands or arms, I mean, it immediately turned septic. And that was because of the millions of flies. I mean, they were just thriving on all the dead bodies and all the things that was going on there. And they were just a pest. You couldn't keep these flies away from you. And they were there, and you got these septic sores all over the place.
But all this together, it must have reduced the efficiency of the unit, having these sort of debilitating things. I mean, were you aware of that, that you were losing efficiency as a fighting force because everybody was so ill?
I don't know. We just kept on. We kept on with it and kept on those who went sick, some people went sick, and were invalided out, and the remainder, perhaps we weren't as bad as the others, a bit tougher, I don't know. But we just kept on with our jobs, and as I say, we just carried on with it.
Did you get any reinforcement drafts?
We got with very, very few reinforcements. I don't know whether I told you that the first batch of reinforcements we got were probably sometime after the 4th of June, I said, then beginning of July. And the share that I got from my section of the rifle, probably 6 or 7 came in, and they come from England, from the feeding battalion of the 5th Manchester. I think it was the 3rd, 5th, who was stationed at Southport. That was supposed to be the feeding battalion for us. But they were very, very badly trained.
How did that show itself?
Well, it showed itself in the one man in particular, when he had no fire. He'd never had any firing practice at all. He never used a rifle. He never used live ammunition at all. And I remember taking a party of these boys down into the gully. That was the Krithia Gully in Nulla, and had some practice of rifle shooting, showing them target shooting there, before they could be put on duty in the trenches. Anyway, this room got used to it, and they turned out all right. But they were very, very badly trained.
How much artillery fire was there during the period?
Well, we'd always got the battleships, you know, there, and they used to fire from time to time. They used to have spasmodic firing. I don't know. And then there were all the field batteries firing. The French had got their 75s and so forth. So there was always a certain amount of shell firing going on.
How about Turkish shell
fire? Oh, yes, they used to shell us just the same thing.
Would there be much of it, Turkish?
Oh, yes, because, I mean, there's certainly plenty of it there, but it didn't seem to be quite as concentrated as our shell firing was. But it was always coming over from time to time. Not only from the direct line in front of us, but we used to get shells coming over from the Asiatic side. There were some big guns at Shanak, I think it was, across the straits there. They used to shell very often, and they used to shell down at the base around where the ships were unloading, around the water, the sea, and so forth. They seemed to concentrate on there because there were a lot of troops and stores and so forth.
What about sniping? You've mentioned it briefly. Was there much sniping on both sides, or was it mainly the Turks?
Well, it was mainly on the Turk side there because they knew the ground there, and I think I mentioned before it was all sorts of scrubland and there's sort of plenty of little hiding places, and even they seem to get behind our line somewhere with one or two little farms round about there and odd bits of buildings there. And there was quite a lot of sniping.
What precautions did you have to take against it?
Well, the only precaution you could take is trying to keep your head down if you're in the trenches there. Because, I mean, there might be sniping from the front line there. The main thing was, I mean, if you... In the daytime in particular, you had to be very, very careful. You didn't get your head above the trench there. Oh, we did have periscopes, by the way, which we could use for spotting, looking in front, you know. And, of course, I mean, sometimes night time, I mean, you there was a better chance of raising your head and looking for seeing what was going on there. But in the daytime, I mean, normally it was asking for it if you... It started showing your head above the trench there.
Did you have many casualties?
There were always casualties going on, sort of kept coming on. Somebody was getting wounded and odd
from
ones
sniping,
killed.
I mean?
Well, both from sniping and from the firing from the other trenches as well.
Would you fire your own weapons much during this period? Did you actually... Would there be much reason or opportunity?
Most of the firing seemed to go on at night time, because people that was the time that you're probably expecting, or you didn't know what to expect there. And if a sentry has thought he saw something, perhaps he did see something, he would open fire, and very often that would lead to someone else opening fire. And I've known a ripple of firing coming right across the lines, something like that. I never really knew what was happening.
Would you fire your rifle ever?
Well, as I said, everybody fired their rifle sometime or other, but normally, I mean, I hadn't got a position on the trench, and my job was to travel to see that the men were in the firing position. But I did occasionally, I did take my place in the firing. And then, as I say, at that June 4th, when there was a counterattack coming on like that, I mean, I got my rifle in two-part like everybody else. So we just followed, that's it.
Would you go on any patrols at night as a sergeant? Reconnaissance or...?
In my sector, we had an advanced SAP, which was a trench at right angles pointing out towards the Turkish lines. And that was a sort of an advance post, and we always had some one part of the section would be there, one or two men would man that, but No, I don't think I ever went out at night on any patrols or anything of that sort of thing.
What about wiring parties? Would they go out?
Well, the wiring parties, after the line was consolidated, they, of course, you got the engineers and so forth, the experts, I mean, too, and the line, the wire was kept more or less intact. So if there's any repairs to the wiring done by Telfire, it was usually done by the engineers.
So that's when you're in the line. When you were back at reserve, where exactly would you go to?
Well, when we were back in reserve, well, I mean, the line never advanced more than 2 or 3 miles, I should think, forward. And if you were in reserve, you were within firing range anyway. But
did life differ in reserve, when you were in the reserve trenches?
Well, it differed in this way, that we weren't in the front line. We weren't on front line duties. So the duties varied. We might have been in the first reserve there, which meant that we were on standby, ready to assist the front line in case of any attack or any trouble there. Then if we went further back, you were probably in brigade or divisional reserve, and you could take things a bit easy. Then you went a bit further back, and then you'd be on fatigue duties, sort of thing. We never seemed to get any rest or anything like that. We always had something to do. And one of the duties that we had from the back portion of the peninsula was the helping to unload ships and get stores that had been unloaded up the line. And one rather interesting job that I got one time was being asked to unload a small trawler, to unload the stores completely from the trawler. There were no sailors there on the ship when we got there, and it was a case of W Beach.
Pardon? At W Beach.
No, that wasn't on W Beach. More towards the W. It was a V Beach, I think it was. That would be V Beach. How much are we on there?
Carry on.
Yes, I think it was V Beach. It was really not very far from the next to Gully Beach, anyway. And we got to the ship there, and there didn't seem to be anybody there to give us instructions. So I asked if there's anybody in the party knew anything about working a winch, because to unload the ship, it was necessary to use this winch to get things from the hold and off the ship. So there's one of my lads who was in civil life, had worked on the railway, was a fireman on the railway, and evidently knew something about steam engines. So he said he could work this winch, so he had the job of doing that. Then there were others down at the bottom of the hold who were there to get the stores together and tie them onto the end of the rope and ready to be wound up onto deck. Then another party to get from deck onto the shore. So after a bit of trying and experimenting, we did very well. The men down below had great difficulty in getting the parcels correctly tied together so that they went up intact. As a matter of fact, once or twice they didn't go up intact. I mean, they just slipped out from the rope and went clattering down in the hold again. But anyway, the chaps got used to it after a bit of practice, and we became quite expert, and we cleared all the stores out.
What kind of stores were they?
Well, I don't know. They were general stores. I suppose they were clothing and parcels and food and goodness knows what, ammunition. All sorts of general stores.
And where were they taken once you got them ashore?
Well, then they had to go then to where there was a sort of brigade dump there where they would be sorted out and distributed according to the ammunition we kept on one side. And that would go up to the line and then the clothing would go through to the various quartermasters. So they had to be distributed from the back regions to the front in stages.
And what other sort of working party duties would you be given when you were in?
Well, the other duties we got very often were after ships had been unloaded, was to hunt the stores then further inland, I mean, to the battalion or brigade stores. One of the hard jobs was the ammunition, because the ammunition were in wooden cases, were pretty heavy, and there was certainly, that was quite a hard job.
Did you, while we're on this, when you were in reserve, would you get letters or parcels from home?
Well, for quite a while after we got there, as you would expect, we didn't get letters at all for a time. But after we'd been there probably a month or so, then letters and parcels started dribbling in. But there seemed to be few and far between. Perhaps towards the end, I mean, perhaps they did become rather more regularly. But it was quite often that when we got the parcels, they were in a pretty battered condition. As a quartermaster sergeant, it was my job to receive these parcels for my own company, and there were times that we just couldn't distinguish one parcel from another. Some of the parcels were, the string had become untied in the parcel, and you had odds and ends of shirts and socks in the sack that had come from battalion headquarters, and the only way was to try and dish them out to the troops fairly.
What would you get in your parcels that came to you?
Well, I got some articles of clothing. I remember early on in the campaign, it was very, 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 very cold. I think I mentioned that when we landed, it was very cold indeed. And presumably I must have written home sometime and said that I would do with a warmer vest. I remember getting a very thick woolen vest there. But probably socks and odds and ends and things like that. Another thing, we used to get a sort of food, Horlicks tablets and things like that.
What kind of thing would you write home when you wrote?
Well, we were instructed. I've been rather surprised, I mean, since the war, about the people who wrote home and told everything, all they knew about what was going on. I don't know, we had a sort of fear of death put into us that we mustn't give any information whatsoever in our letters home that was as to where we were, what we were doing, what fighting was going on and so forth. So, I mean, we just had to write just cheerful letters generally and only vaguely mention about what was going on.
Did the letters you got from home, were they important to you?
Yeah, oh yes, of course, we were very, very glad to hear from people at home and from our parents in particular. But we couldn't depend on them. I mean, these things, as I say, they only came spasmodically. And as far as our writing was concerned, I mean, it got to a stage that you didn't know what to put into your letters. And we used to use what we call field service cards. Where there were a series of questions. I am quite well. I am not well. I have been admitted into hospital. I have been wounded. And you just crossed out whatever things applied to you. And we used to I'd send those on very often instead of a letter, because it was just nothing to write about. If we couldn't say what we were doing and where we were and what all day-to-day events. So I always found it very, very difficult in Gallipoli to write letters at all. Although, I mean, I was pretty good at letter writing, but there we were short of information. At least we weren't supposed to give any information.
Now, were there any other developments before the August battle that you can think of before we come to?
Well, the August, from June till August again, it was the same old job. Up in the front line, back in reserve, our reserve trenches, back on duties, doing fatigues and so on and so forth. And that was going on. And then we used to get rumours, and we didn't get any information. We knew vaguely about the landing in, about the Anzacs being on the other side, on the left-hand side of the peninsula, going nearer to Constantinople, if you put it that way. We got an idea, or rumours, that there was going to be another further landing in the beginning of August. And the preparation we were being made for limited attacks on our side. And this started again by terrific bombardments, trying to give the idea to the Turks that there was going to be, that the main battle was going to be on Hellas again, and not.
Did you know it wasn't going to be at Hellas? Can you just make that clear? Or
no, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know at all. No, we got the impression there was going to be another a big attack from our side.
But you didn't know that the attack at Hellas was just a diversion at
no,
the time?
No, we didn't know at the time.
So to you it was a real attack?
We thought it was a real attack there. It was only later on that we found out that there was really a sort of diversion to divert the Turkish troops and reinforcements to our side so that they could have a better chance of the landing at Suvla and so on. So
the bombardment opened?
The bombardment opened, and there were limited attacks. There were limited attacks there on our front, on various parts of our front.
Was there an attack by your battalion?
Yes, and we on the 5th Battalion. I remember being in one or two. They were sort of hit and run sort of thing. We never captured anything in particular. We used to make short attacks one part of the line. And then get back again there. There were sort of diversions, that's all. That's all I can remember about that, anyway.
Now, after that, you were made company quartermaster sergeant. Could you explain what your duty... You've touched on some of it before, but if you could just sum up your duties were as company quartermaster sergeant.
Yes, well, as I mentioned before, soon after the 6th of August, I think my promotion dated from the 6th or 7th of August, I was made company quartermaster sergeant, obviously to fill a vacancy, because, I mean, as the campaign went on, I mean, there were losses from one reason or another, so there must have been a vacancy in my company for the company quartermaster. He'd either been killed or injured or gone sick or something, I don't know. You just didn't know some of these things. And I was promoted on the spot, and so I took over then. But the main duties of a quartermaster sergeant or a quartermaster are mainly administrative. The thing is to see that the troops are fed, to see that they get all the ammunition that is wanted, see they get all the stores that are required, to see to their uniforms and so on, that sort of thing. Keep a check of the numbers of your men for ration purposes. You'd have to send out a list back to the battalion each day of the number of men you've got on the company on active service, so the rations were based on that. You'd also report any wounded, injured, people gone sick and so forth. So it was really a sort of administration. See that the men were clothed, see that they had ammunition, see that they had all the stores that they wanted.
And how did you go about that, those three, the ammunition, stores and clothing? How did you make sure that those things were done?
Well, there were various platoon sergeants. I mean, you could get your reports back from the various sections of the line. And it was a matter of getting reports from them, getting chits from them, if necessary, or by word of mouth. You know, they absolutely check and make quite certain you've got this information from the people underneath, from NCOs underneath you in there.
And then, what, having got the information and what was needed,
you passed it back to battalion.
That's the
company quartermaster would pass that information then to the battalion quartermaster sergeant, and the battalion quartermaster sergeant was under the officer quartermaster, which was a commissioned rank. His duty was to get all the stores, equipment, food and all the rest of it for the whole of the battalion. So this was a matter of filtering down from the quartermaster through the regimental quartermaster to the company quartermaster sergeant. And then the issue was on the spot. So it was really administrative.
That's all, when he got the request, he'd put that in. And then when the stuff came up, the stores came up, they'd go back
down.
Well,
yes, they would have to go back and get it from the brigade, yes, whoever supplied all these things.
And then they'd come to you?
The ammunition was through the ordnance, there'd be ammunition dumps and so forth. So, I mean, it was a really complete organisation right from the division working back and beyond the division where there were Army Corps and so forth. In our case, it was mainly the division, of course. So it would work from the divisional down to the battalion and then throw down to the companies, right down to the men.
So would the company maintain any stores of its own? Would you control a small store of, I'm thinking of things like rum and food, things like that. Would you have a sort of...
Well, you used to get a daily ration, and as far as possible, you didn't have many stores at all.
You'd
order things. I mean, if there were anything, any clothing needing, if people, tunics had got worn out or torn or something or whatever happened, you just order them. And when they came in, you issued them to the men concerned. And the rations used to come up daily. Whether you were in the line or you were in the reserve, you used to get the rations coming up daily from the battalion quartermaster sergeant, quartermaster stores there. And then your job was to see that they were dished out to the various sections in your company.
Were there any other responsibilities besides this chain?
Well, I think that was quite enough to be going on with there, that if you had to know exactly how many men there were that wanted feeding, and you saw that they were fed, and you saw that they had what ammunition was required, you saw what clothing was required, and I think one thing you mentioned there was, if there was a rum ration, it was seen to be left to the quartermaster to deal with the rum ration. I mentioned about the rum ration being a 64th of a gallon per man, may have given the impression that was per day. But actually the issue of rum from higher up was very spasmodic. It may have been once a week, it may have been once every 5 or 6 weeks, but it certainly wasn't daily. But the procedure with us out in Gallipoli anyway was, when you got a rum ration, you used to deliver it out fairly to the men in the company.
Now you were only 20. Was it not uncommon for people to be? It's quite a senior NCO rank, isn't it? Were there many of your age?
Well, that seemed to go on in my career anyway, because later on in the machine gun corps, I remember the company sergeant major was 21. That was probably the next year I was 21. And it seemed to be there that as casualties occurred there, the replacements came from the ranks, and they were usually the great recruitment for the Territorial Army or any army. Is 18 plus, so presumably when it came to losing officers, either from sickness or losing non-commissioned officers or officers for that matter, from any cause, it was usually the younger people who got the promotion.
So it wasn't unusual then?
Well, it wasn't. It didn't seem to be anyway.
Could you cope with the responsibility at 20? Did you find it difficult?
No, I don't know. I just took it in my stride. I don't know. I was always... They say people just do these things, and it never worried me at all. I mean, I was a corporal in the signalers, and I took that job on. Then I was platoon sergeant. I never thought it was anything particular being a platoon sergeant in the line. I just did the job. When it came to the company quartermaster sergeant, there again, I did the job, and I must have satisfied the people, and that was it.
Now you moved the division moved it from the Nullar area that you'd originally been in Krithia Nullar to over to Gully Ravine after August. Is that correct, or in August rather?
Well, I think it must have been after, actually, I think the beginning of September, I should imagine, that we moved. Yes, we we move from the left centre of the line to the left of the line. We relieve the 29th Division, who were on the left of the line, from the, on the left and right of the Gully Ravine. And they went to, I think they went to Anzac, and along the peninsula. And we took over there. That would be in September.
What did Gully Ravine look like at that time? What was, because it's quite a busy area. What was going on in there?
Well, that was the main gateway to all the trenches on that part of the line, which probably it was like that. Well, it was the main way that all.